Welcome to the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast. The show covering all things health, wellness, culture, and more. The show for all of us who aren't old, we're better. Each week, we'll interview superstars, experts, and ordinary people doing extraordinary things, all related to this wonderful experience of getting better, not just older. Now, here's your host, the award-winning Paul Vogelzang.
Welcome to an absolutely riveting episode of the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast. Today, we are embarking on just a fascinating journey through time, exploring the dynamic intersections of faith, fortune, and the foundational fabric of American society. In this episode titled Evangelicalism in America, we delve deep into the heart of how evangelicalism and economic ambition have shaped and reshaped the landscape of the nation. Join us as we sit down with the distinguished Smithsonian Associate Joseph Slaughter, Assistant Professor of History at Wesleyan University, and an expert whose insightful research casts a revealing light on the complex tapestry of American identity. Through Joseph Slaughter's lens, we will uncover today the intriguing story of American evangelicalism, tracing its roots back to the early European settlements and navigating through its profound influence over the centuries. Dr. Joseph Slaughter will be appearing at Smithsonian Associates coming up, so please check out our show notes today for more details. But we have Dr. Joe Slaughter today in what will be a wonderful episode and brief tease on what's to come at Smithsonian Associates. But that's not all. We dive into the pages of Dr. Joseph Slaughter's compelling new book, Faith in Markets, which offers a groundbreaking exploration of the 19th century Protestant revivals and the dramatic expansion of the marketplace. Today, we will learn about visionary entrepreneurs who, driven by their faith, embarked on business ventures that aimed not just at profit, but at molding a moral and Christian marketplace. From the sophisticated textile factories of George Rapp and Associates to the virtuous publishing endeavors of Harper and Brothers, we uncover how these pioneers attempted to weave their religious convictions with their commercial aspirations. Religion and capitalism. Prepare to be engaged, prepare to be informed, and perhaps even transformed as we navigate the intricate dance of evangelicalism and capitalism in America. This isn't just history, it's a story of beliefs, business, and the pursuit of a better society. Welcome to the Smithsonian Associates interview series on the Not Old Better Show. Today's title is Evangelicalism in America, and Joe Slaughter is our guest. Dr. Joseph Slaughter, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's great to be back.
It's so nice to talk to you. I hope you're well. Congratulations on your new book, which we were going to talk about. We're going to do a more expanded interview on this book titled Faith in Markets. Today, we're going to spend our time talking about your upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation, which I'm really excited about, Evangelicalism in America. And I wonder if you'd just start by telling us briefly about your presentation and how you'll use Zoom to engage our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I try to start, since I'm a historian, with sort of the origins of the term and its usage, which is shortly after the Reformation. So we do spend just a little bit of time, you know, going that far back in the history, but most of it really then centers on the beginning of European immigration to North America, and particularly, you know, English settlements in places like New England in the 1600s, and trying to understand a little bit of what that culture looked like and how it then spawned something that by the 19th century people were calling and labeling as a group of people, you know, evangelical. And then moving into the 20th century, where it becomes something that's more culturally, I think, potentially divisive in terms of what it means in an increasingly pluralistic society. And so we try to look at just different little signposts along the way. It's not trying to be a comprehensive history by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that my goal is to introduce both complexity and nuance into talking about the history of evangelicalism in the United States, that there are many, I think, probably admirable aspects of its history over the centuries, and there are some things that probably are maybe less so. But providing that full spectrum, as well as the diversity of what increasingly gets lumped under that word and that definition, is probably, you know, the second goal of it. And I'm a very visually oriented person, so I have a lot of images, different sort of references to historical moments that I'll use throughout the conversation with the audience, so that people aren't just staring at a talking head for the entire time.
So. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I would imagine that some of the images are going to be really powerful, because the identity of evangelicals has really evolved and over the centuries. Tell us a little bit about that and how some of the origins have shaped kind of the identity today.
Yeah, I mean, I think in brief, the word starts out more as a descriptor, mm-hmm. and originally in the Reformation period, it simply is meaning people that are not considering themselves Catholic or in some sort of opposition to Catholicism. And so it's more of a descriptor. And then by the 1700s, it's increasingly identified with a kind of revivalism. And it's describing, you know, a more emotive, what they would have used as a term, enthusiasm, to describe that sort of religious experience for people. And it's not really until the 19th century that it starts becoming a noun. Mm-hmm. But what we learn in the 19th century is, not unlike today, the word loses its usefulness because almost everybody includes themselves under that umbrella, whether somebody is a Methodist or even a Unitarian. People are thinking about themselves under a similarly broadly Protestant umbrella that uses evangelical almost interchangeably. And then, you know, that's almost where we're at today, where the term is undergoing sort of a transformation from what it meant, say, in the era of Billy Graham, to what it means today. And that's some of what's changed. And that's, if somebody attended, you know, my talk, you know, years ago, mm-hmm. they're going to hear some similar information, but some of it is going to diverge in trying to explain how that term is really changed a lot, especially over the last 5 to 10 years.
And so the term and its identity has changed. Growth and influence has changed too over some of these time periods. What are some of those factors that have contributed to the growth, the influence, and how it's really kind of made its way in a more prominent manner since the 18th century to present day?
So I think there's always been important ways in which people that would identify in these communities, or we can sort of try to, in our best historical analysis, put into these sort of labels as we look at different communities of Protestants in American history, that they've always, and that's something that, you know, when we get into my book conversation, I think the book makes clear that there's a continuity there. I think what's different now is just that evangelical is starting to become synonymous with Republican in a way that it hasn't necessarily been in other periods of history. So I think you're always going to find people that fall under this category as being involved in the marketplace, involved in politics at the local or the national level, but that it registers differently now because of how partisan some of that involvement looks now, and increasingly as people who study this more as political scientists and sociologists and social scientists have, I think, very convincingly underscored, are aligning themselves in very sort of clearly defined political ways, so that it probably makes us now see the group differently and makes them appear to be more influential or more involved than maybe in prior eras.
Hi, it's Paul. Do you love entertaining, informative, eclectic, insightful programs about culture, health, science, life, and everything Smithsonian? As part of our Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast, we're introducing you to the new Smithsonian Associates streaming series. Smithsonian, a nonprofit organization, is excited to present this new aspect of their 55 years as the world's largest museum-based educational program. Join us from the comfort of your home as we periodically interview Smithsonian Associate guest speakers. Our audience here on radio and podcast can explore our website for more information, links, and details at notold-better.com. Thanks, everybody. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph Slaughter, Smithsonian Associate, who's been with us previously. Very popular subject, very popular guest, going to be talking about evangelicalism in America. We'll put links so that our audience can find out more information about Dr. Slaughter. And, of course, his new book, which we're going to chat about just briefly coming up here. The title of his book is Faith in Markets, Christian Capitalism in the Early American Republic. So let's talk a little bit, Dr. Slaughter, about how evangelicalism has kind of reached across multiple denominations, even regions and ethnicities. Talk to us a little bit about the diversity within the evangelical movement. You say now it's a big wide umbrella, but it wasn't always that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, as I, you know, as we'll talk about some in the conversation with the Smithsonian Associates, mm-hmm. you know, in the 19th century, it really was extremely broad, and it encompassed most of all the different denominations present in the United States, which was predominantly Protestant. I think what's interesting in terms of the diversity that you're talking about, and this is where we get into conversations about how you're actually going to define evangelicalism. A couple of years ago at Wesleyan, we had William Barber, African-American minister who's prominently involved with Moral Mondays and advocacies for poverty initiatives and things like that. And he came and received an honorary degree. And I had shared with some of my students a little bit of his background prior to him coming to commencement, because I thought it was interesting that as a very liberal, progressive individual, he had a profile in New York Times Magazine where he actually identified as an evangelical, which is not super necessarily common across the board in the African-American Protestant community, even though a lot of studies have demonstrated that they share many of the markers of belief that people have often used to try to categorize white Protestants as evangelicals, such as the high authority of the Bible, the centrality of Christ to one's salvation, belief in needing to have a conversion experience. You know, these sorts of markers are every bit as common in black Protestantism as they are in white Protestantism, but relatively few black Protestants traditionally have used that label to describe themselves. When here you had a very liberal progressive activist black minister who was claiming that label for himself. So I think that's just one example of how broad the category can be. And then I think what's really surprising now is that, particularly with the research from some people like Ryan Burge, who's at Eastern Illinois University. He's published a lot of stuff in a lot of different places, Politico, I mean, all over the – so some of your readers may have come across his name and may be familiar with one of the things that he has pointed out that increasingly you actually even have Hindu and Muslim Americans who identify as being evangelical, because increasingly the definition doesn't have as much to do about the things I just described that might characterize a Black Protestant, even if they don't use that label for themselves. But increasingly, it seems to communicate to people, if I'm a religious individual and I'm politically conservative, then I'm an evangelical. And then that's how you end up with a stat like half of the Muslims who attend services in a mosque more than once a week and ally with the Republicans self-identify as evangelical. Which seems probably surprising to people,
yeah.
But it shows how that word and that term is undergoing a category which it's enfolding. Maybe more people or different groups of people that previously we would have never thought to use that label for.
So is there a collective voice, almost a collective influence among evangelicals, or is it disparate and as widely kind of viewed as all the ethnicities that make it up?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the issues with evangelicalism is, like Protestantism in general, it doesn't really have a unified voice, mm-hmm. In the same way that we could, and even saying that about something like Catholicism is a problem too, obviously, because even though you have a hierarchical structure with the Pope at the head, we all know there's a lot of voices within Catholicism, and they're not all speaking in uniform. But particularly in Protestantism, the very nature of it means that it's going to speak with a discordant voice. But I do think that from the era of Trump onward, so like the last, maybe 9-10 years, increasingly you do see some very decided splits within at least white Protestant evangelicalism, and that alignment is typically revolving around kind of support or opposition to former President Trump. And associated with that is a difference between what those different communities identify as the most pressing problems that need to be addressed. Those that typically are supporting President Trump typically see problems external to their community within the United States as being the most pressing problems, whether that's abortion or whether that's issues of sexual identity or maybe even, immigration, that those are the most pressing issues that need to be spoken to by not just politics, but also pulpits and churches more broadly. On the other hand, there's probably maybe less visible voice to the general public because they're not featured quite as much on mainstream media outlets and maybe don't even as sophisticatedly make use of social media. Those within evangelicalism that are more opposed to President Trump typically are identifying more pressing problems as those within their church community. And primarily those are some of the evangelicals that are concerned about something like Christian nationalism and seeing that as much more of a pressing threat, not only to the country, but even more so, they're probably really concerned about the health and integrity of their churches and seeing it as a threat to that. So somebody that fits into that category would be somebody like Tim Alberta, who just published the Kingdom and the Power and the Glory, a wonderful investigation by an evangelical into what's transpired over the last 10 years to 20 years within his community. And some of your readers may be familiar with that book because it's a bestseller, and Tim Alberta has been on all sorts of different media outlets talking about this book over the last several months. And so I would recommend that as a good sort of exploration by an evangelical who's speaking from a concern, like I said, more internally rather than external. Although I think Tim Alberta would think, as many of these people do as well, that some of these problems that they're concerned about within their community also have negative consequences for the country at large, too.
It's really a fascinating time, and we're just on the verge of another, well, we're real smack dab into it, I guess, another election cycle. And I'm not hearing these names, you know, associated with this election cycle as in terms of Trump. We used to hear so much about groups like the Christian Coalition, names like Ralph Reed, perhaps. What are the shifts that you've observed in this area of political engagement of evangelicals over the years? And is their influence on the wane? Is it growing? Are people like Tim Alberta emerging now as kind of the leader, I suppose, of the evangelical discussion?
I don't think I would label somebody like Tim Alberta as a leader of the discussion. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a moment during the Trump administration when there was a meeting of people that are probably in the more the Tim Alberta category up at Wheaton College in Illinois, which traditionally these sort of places of higher education often spoke as the voice of sort of mainstream evangelicalism, if we could call it that, places like Wheaton, mm-hmm. or Gordon Conwell Seminary or Fuller or Messiah College, you know, these sorts of places were oftentimes where those voices were powerful. When this group convened at Wheaton during the Trump administration, I wouldn't say it was within the first couple of years of his administration, and their purpose was, like, what do? We don't really agree with necessarily the direction of the Trump administration and even how it seems to be pulling evangelicalism in a direction that we're not really super thrilled with. There were several prominent people within the Trump orbit that said, who's there? I'm not there. Mm-hmm. None of like my colleagues are there. Mm-hmm. They don't speak for evangelicalism. So this idea of who speaks for it, you know, that's a whole nother contested area or subject. I would say that the people that still have some sway, and there are some people from the old religious right, people like Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Gary Bauer is still involved somewhat. He and James Dobson started a new organization because James Dobson sort of had an acrimonious parting from Focus on the Family years ago, in part because I think some of the ways he was sort of entering into the cultural discussions in a more combative kind of way. Some of those old guard people are still influential, and I think they still have the voice, particularly of a generation that listened to them and were involved in those politics in the 80s and then in the 90s. So for that generation, many of those old guard folks still have currency and are still influential. I think what's a little bit different is you now do have some newer people who gained their bona fides less through building what we might call effective parachurch organizations that were explicitly Christian. You know, somebody like Dobson, Focus on the Family, was the basis of his legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a lot, and actually my colleague at Messiah, John Fia, just wrote a wonderful article in The Atlantic about the influence of Dobson on his family and his dad. Mm-hmm. And how, wow, for whatever, you know, recent things Dobson might be offensive about, that he took, in this case, a working class, distant father and transformed, and his teachings transformed him into somebody that was more engaged and loving and ultimately more productive as a member of their family for both the kids and his mother. And so there's lots of testimonies like that about somebody like Dobson. And so his legitimacy came through the creation of this sort of thing that, you know, it had political ramifications, but that was not the primary reason of being. He's a Christian psychologist trying to dispense basically Christian-minded advice for, you know, families and children. And now, though, you know, the way that sort of a newer breed of political operators, and this isn't true just of evangelicalism, of course, it's true of lots of different political communities, their legitimacy is coming from very different sort of sources. And in some places, there's almost no basis for them being anointed as platform voices within the community. I mean, for me, a good example of this is somebody like Charlie Kirk, who created almost out of just a few strategic connections he made within sort of conservative politics and sort of pioneering through social media and campus organizing a new sort of combative rhetoric that dovetailed perfectly with the kind of rhetoric of former President Trump, and built this huge now apparatus with Turning Point USA that is extremely influential and tight with the whole Trump family, and will be, I think, continue to be an important voice and organizing apparatus for, you know, Trump's reelection campaign. I think that some of those, I guess to summarize, some of the old voices I think are still important. They're supplemented by some of these newer voices, like a Charlie Kirk, who are also really powerful and formidable fundraisers in their own right.
You have a new book, Faith in Markets: Christian Capitalism in the Early American Republic, and you write about these businesses, and you write about how this has been going on, and certainly, you know, for any of us who watched the Super Bowl, we saw advertising that was very pointed at with a Christian message. Those of us who live in the Washington, D.C. area know of the Bible Museum. And of course, mm-hmm. the funding for that came from Hobby Lobby, another very prominent business in the United States. And we all know about Chick-fil-A and the fact that they're closed on Sunday with a very religious kind of message behind that. Tell us maybe a little bit about your book, because we are going to have an extended conversation about faith in markets, but maybe kind of bring us current with how this has changed and how this landscape is shaping evangelicalism through business.
Yeah, I'll just try to sort of provide a brief preview for Good. What our conversation will be in more depth. And I would actually argue, I'm not sure these businesses have changed as much as the culture around them has changed dramatically. So an example of this would be my good colleague Nicole Kirk wrote a wonderful book about John Wanamaker. I'm sure maybe some of your listeners have listened to the magnificent organ mm-hmm. in what was Wanamaker's department store in Philadelphia, and it's a Macy's now. But Wanamaker, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, envision this as like a temple of business, essentially. And he weaved his fundamentalist Protestantism into his business in very public ways, to the point which the criticism that Wanamaker got was less about integrating his ardent sort of Protestant beliefs into his business, but more that he wasn't seen as actually being Christian enough, that he was fraudulent, that he was too materialistic, that, wow. you know, he was too commercialized. Wow. That was more of what the criticism revolved around, that right. he was hypocritical. Whereas I would say today, you know, similar kind of businesses are criticized for being too religious mm-hmm. and inserting their values into the marketplace in ways that are becoming increasingly controversial. And, you know, obviously the Hobby Lobby situation with the Supreme Court case mm-hmm. is one of those. And that actually led me to the topic in the first place, because in her dissent in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby in 2014, the late Justice Ginsburg said that history wasn't really on the side of for-profit businesses exhibiting religious identities in the marketplace. And that's a sort of a rough paraphrase of what she said. And that just struck me as interesting, because I was coming across lots of businesses in the 19th century that clearly had religious imperatives, and it was woven into the very fabric of their existence and purpose. And so that kind of led me into investigating that. And I think that the takeaway for your readers and why they might find it interesting is, For progressives and liberals, it's probably helpful to realize this longer history of religious businesses, for good or for ill, And that that's been a feature of the marketplace in North America for a long time. And then for conservatives who might be more sympathetic to a free market capitalist kind of ideal, to see that some of these early 19th century businesses actually had critiques of the emerging capitalist system that might be interesting for those, you know, more conservative supporters of the capitalist system to listen to and to hear about. And so I think, you know, for both perspectives, I think there's some interesting takeaways and surprises in the book.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to this upcoming conversation. I've had a good time today. I could talk to you for a long time, Dr. Slaughter, and I enjoy really this opportunity, and I know our audience will. You will be presenting at Smithsonian Associates coming up, and the title of your presentation is Evangelicalism in America. We're going to talk again here very soon about your new book, Faith in Markets. Thank you so much for your time today. Have a great rest of your day, and I look forward to seeing you at Smithsonian Associates. And I look forward to our conversation about faith in markets. We'll talk in depth about some of the entrepreneurs, some of their faith, and how we can learn from some of these enterprises and better understand evangelicals and their business practices. But thanks, Dr. Slaughter. Look forward to our upcoming conversation with you.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's always a pleasure to be here and chat with you. And I'm looking forward to both talking with the Smithsonian Associates as well as our follow-on conversation about faith in markets.
My thanks to Smithsonian Associates, Joseph Slaughter, Assistant Professor of History at Wesleyan University. Dr. Joseph Slaughter will be appearing at Smithsonian Associates coming up, so please check out our show notes today for more details. My thanks always to the Smithsonian team for all they do to support the show. My thanks to you, our wonderful audience here on radio and podcast. Please be well, be safe, and let's talk about better. The Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast. Thanks, everybody, and we will see you next week.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates interview series on radio and podcast.